So we'll start on page 34 in the Gold Prayer Book, or
when do we shake hands?
This white binder also has all the prayers that we do on Sunday mornings, and you would just go to the first page that has text in there. And we will start on page 34 with Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra, which we will say three times.
So by the way, this mantra, all the teachings of the Buddha have been distilled into this mantra. So when you say this mantra, you're basically taking the distillation of all the Buddha's teachings and putting that imprint on your mind. So you want to think of it as something very helpful and powerful and beneficial to your mind.
Tayata
Omune Mune Mahamunaye Soha Tayata Omune Mune Mahamunaye Soha
And now we will say the Medicine Buddha stanza, followed by the mantra seven times. Bhagavan, with equal compassion for all, whose name when merely heard dispels the suffering of the lower realms, dispeller of disease and the three poisons, I prostrate to Medicine Buddha, lapis light. And we'll start really slowly with the mantra and then speed up a little bit.
Again, this is another one of these mantras that has a healing effect for those of us with medical conditions, but also lots of people all over the world. It benefits our mind to be able to help others in that way.
Okay. Teata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samudgate Soha Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samudgate Soha And now we'll go down to the four immeasurables, which we will say three times in English. And it's good to think a little bit and take it a little bit slowly and think about what we're actually wishing here. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And now if you'll
so
turn the...
Let me say something about that. So the first stanza, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness is immeasurable. That's the definition of immeasurable love. The second stanza is may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering is the definition of immeasurable compassion. Then the next line, inseparable from happiness that is free from suffering is immeasurable joy. And then the last line, abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies is immeasurable equanimity. So those are the four immeasurables, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now if you'll turn the page, and at the bottom of page 37, we'll chant Chen Rezig's mantra 8 times and Green Tara's mantra 7 times.
Chen Rezig is the Buddha. We have images of Dazen Chen Rezig, and we think of Chen Rezig is the manifestation of compassion, and then Omtari Tatari. That's Green Tara. She's the manifestation of compassionate action. So these are all. So saying these mantras and the vibration affects our nervous system and our mind, and it helps us develop compassion and the compassionate action. That's the purpose, the benefit of saying these mantras.
Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha.
Okay, and the children can go to their classes now.
Ouch. Anybody here named Victoria? Is that the collection bowl?
Yeah.
We need to fill it up.
Passing it right away, yes.
Gosh, look at the room for the spirits to sit. The hungry ghosts. Oh, well. I'm only talking to the first two rows. For the rest of you. Anyway. Okay. So now, the next step is to turn to a couple of people around and introduce yourself, particularly people that you might be afraid of, or that you don't, people you don't know particularly. Introduce yourself and you know, you could do that. What do they do in Catholicism? May peace be with you or something. You could do that even, or you could say a mantra to them or whatever. Don't forget to say your name.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little girl in the back of the room that somebody needs to say hi to. Hey, thank you. Wearing that cold shoulder shirt. Anyway, let's see. Can we, Robbie, do you mind bringing the whiteboard in here since there's some people that don't learn? That's their problem. No, I'm kidding. Anyway, it's nice to have something to write on because we can't remember things, can we? And some of us are visually minded. You know, we learn by looking. We don't learn necessarily by just hearing. And so I'm all about writing things down. Now, that looks good. That's a good start. This right there is good. Now, if you don't mind staying here and writing while I come up with things to say. So, you know, I tried to get Lama Zopa to help us, you know, when we were at the Light of the Path retreat. By the way, I'm Don Brown. I've been involved with Kadampa Center for a long time, and I'm teaching a class now called How to Develop Bodhicitta on Monday nights, but this is kind of part of that class. It's not that. For those of you, it might be some repetition here, but when I go back to what I was saying, Robbie, there's nothing to write with. There's no eraser. Anyway, whatever. It's dirty. Merely labeled dirty. Okay. Anyway. So, yes, I was kind of joking, but I said, we need to change the name to Kadampa Center instead of for the practice of Tibetan Buddhism and the Mahayana, in the Gelug tradition, whatever. Isn't that what we are?
Yeah.
I think so. Anyway, I thought Kadampa Center for educating and practicing in the development of compassion, because I think that's what we are all about, bottom line. At the end of the day, there are two wings to the bird of enlightenment. One is compassion, and the other is wisdom, and they work together. So you need both. And compassion is not what we think it is, I'll bet. You know, we don't automatically develop compassion. I mean, when you see these pictures of these children in Somalia or in these African countries in particular, you know, that have protein malnutrition with swollen bellies and orange hair and flies all over them and they're dying, you know, your heart goes out, right? You feel something. And then they ask you for money. You know, because they know that touches your heart. But compassion's really has to do, the kind of compassion that we're looking at developing here. Well, let me say this. If a lot of people here have issues with our current president, right? So if you hear that he's sick or having a bad day, you tend to go, yeah, you know? It's not like hearing or seeing suffering causes compassion to arise, right? It doesn't happen that way. It's only when we feel connected to people or animals or insects or who knows what. We talk in Buddhism about beings of the six realms, right? We can only see the animal realm and the human realm, but we talk about this vast expanse of sentient beings. And you know, we right now we pretty much only have compassion for the people that are near and dear, right? And the people that are we don't care about, or you know, we read about, you know, 500 people dying in a boat accident in Bangladesh. We go, oh, that's sad. I mean, that's too bad. We don't feel any particular compassion for those beings, and then the people that we dislike, we actually rejoice often in their difficulties. So we need to find the attitude that we're looking for in Buddhism to develop is called universal compassion, which is which is basically excludes no one. It embraces not only the people that we love, and I'm distinguishing love from attachment, although they go together for most of us, the people that we love, the people that we don't know, the so-called strangers, which is the vast majority of living beings, and then the people that we feel aversion toward. And sometimes we use the word enemies, but we're far too sophisticated to use the word enemy. I don't have any enemies. There's some people I really dislike, though. Like my boss, or, you know, somebody that annoys me at work, or just anybody that you see them and you just naturally have. Could be a spider, you know, if you wanted to work with some animal, but a cockroach, you know, but actually there are people that we do, when we see them, and instantly we feel some aversion toward them, at least today. Maybe tomorrow, next week, we might develop more of a sense of connection. Different things could change, right? These relationships are always in a state of flux. So anyway, compassion is the goal, and we need to understand what that means, and we need to, in a minute. So my intention, although I don't know if I have time because this could go on for hours, but what I'd like to do today is talk a little bit about compassion and then go back and talk about equanimity. Because it's impossible. If we want to develop universal compassion, that is a sense of universal responsibility for all living beings, we have to get rid of the mind of partiality, don't we? Where some are close, some we feel, the vast majority we feel totally indifference towards, and then there's a little subset over here that we definitely feel aversion toward, right? So as long as we have this mind of partiality, impossible to develop universal compassion. So what we want to do is to level the playing field and develop basically a neutral attitude to all sentient beings. And gradually from that, that becomes the foundation for developing this palace of compassion and ultimately universal responsibility and bodhicitta, right? So we have to go start out developing a sense of neutrality or equanimity for all living beings. Now that's crucial. And every quality that we're trying to develop here at Kadampa Center, that we are training in, love, compassion, patience, and all those things, the foundation of it is equanimity. We have to, the Mahayana motive is, and Lama Zopa said, we should be talking about this every time we open our mouths at Kadampa Center. The motivation for practice is to help all living beings, to help others, right? Totally selfless attitude, so opposite to how we ordinarily think. The method to do that is to develop ourselves into a Buddha. In other words, to eliminate our faults and develop all the qualities of love, compassion, power, skillful means. So that's what it means to be a Buddha. So our goal is to help others. The method to do that is one's own enlightenment. And the key to that, the keys to that are understanding or developing not just intellectually, but some sort of heartfelt compassion. And the foundation for that is the meditational equanimity. I just want to say a few words about the distinction between compassion and empathy. How many people think they're the same thing? Well, somebody's been in here brainwashing. Anyway, I'm not going to... there's a couple of pages here. I have new glasses that don't work. I have to hold them out here. Anyway, I'll try to read a little bit of it, but I won't bore you with reading all of it. The point of, I'll give you the gist of it. I'll read the first paragraph and then go from there. To generate a compassionate state may sometimes entail the meditative feeling that what another person is feeling, but having one's emotions resonate empathetically with the feelings of another person does not by itself suffice to yield a compassionate mindset. The meditation must also be driven by an unselfish desire to help someone who is suffering. This form of meditation on love and compassion has proved to be more than just a spiritual exercise. It is shown to benefit healthcare workers, teachers, and others who run the risk of emotional burnout linked to the distress experienced from a deeply empathetic reaction to another person's plight. The meditator begins by focusing on an unconditional feeling of benevolence and love toward others, accompanied by silent repetition of the phrase conveying intent, such as may all beings find happiness and the causes of happiness and be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So remember we did those in the prayer, may all beings be free, find happiness and the causes of happiness. Okay? So that's love. So right away we're actually developing love, because without that there's no compassion, right? With animosity, you can't have compassion. So we start out developing love, and then may all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That's the definition of universal compassion. So they taught these people to say these words, but also to connect to the meaning of the words. So just saying the words doesn't do anything, does it? May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering, and may all beings be happiness and the causes of suffering, causes of happiness. Just saying those words doesn't do anything. So we have to, the words have to resonate. We have to understand at some heartfelt level what these words mean. That universal love, universal compassion. But anyway, they taught these people to say these words over and over again and connect to the meaning of it. Then they had another group. So they had these scientists, and they did PET scans, and this was, by the way, Scientific American, those of you who care, November 2014. It was the neuroscience of meditation. Okay, very interesting. And so what they tried to do, they did a meditation. They taught one group how to do meditate on compassion using that little phrase I told you. And the other group, they taught the meditations were on empathy, okay? Developing an empathic state of mind. So they found out that the people who meditated on compassion, maybe I'll read something here, so y'all don't think I'm making this up. All right. Preliminary results showed that after a week of meditation-based loving, kindness, and compassion, novice subjects watch video clips showing suffering people with more positive and benevolent feelings. The other subjects who devoted a week to the experimental regimen that cultivated empathy experienced emotions that resonated deeply with others' suffering. But these emotions also brought about negative feelings and thoughts, and this group experienced more distress, sometimes to the point of not being able to control their emotions. So what they're saying is that the group that meditated on compassion, it was associated with more positive mind states, whereas the group that meditated on empathy alone, the other people's suffering resonated with them, but it also created a lot of distress in their mind. And so they went back and taught the people who they had meditated on. And by the way, they were looking at the prefrontal cortex, and they could see that there were different parts of the brain lighting up when people were meditating on compassion versus empathy. Okay? And so they taught the people that had been taught to meditate on empathy, on compassion, and what happened was the distress in their mind diminished, okay? And they also had a more positive experience when they were confronted with other people suffering, the images of seeing others suffer. So that's an important distinction, because I think and I've had some people say this, and I just invite you to look into it. You don't have to believe it. But in the medical profession, the burnout rate, I think, is like 60% or more, and they call it empathy burnout. And we had a lady in one of the classes, I don't see her today, but she was 25 years in the NICU. And when I read this article to her, she said, I used to see this all the time. It was so true. It was true amongst the caregivers, but also the parents, you know, who empathized so deeply with their children suffering that they weren't able to actually be much help. So compassion is what we're shooting for. That's the target in Buddhism. Empathy seems to me, you know, there's a moment where we do empathize with people's suffering. I mean, I think that's important. That's how we recognize suffering, isn't it? As we go, well, that's why, if I was in that situation, I'd be suffering. But we don't stop there. We go the next step and wish them to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So, any questions so far? Any doubters? Yes.
You want us to write it on the board?
We'll do that in a minute. There is a distinction there.
It's streaming.
Do you want us to write it on the board?
I just asked if you wanted me to write it on the board or somewhere.
In a minute. Thank you for sharing. We have a little participation here.
I have a comment.
Go.
I was here, we had this discussion before about empathy and compassion, and I thought a lot about it, and I guess I was thinking about just that often I find myself in that position where I empathize without, like I just am an empathetic person, but I do find I shut down when I start to empathize too deeply with the other person. So I guess I was thinking about how to infuse my empathy with compassion so that it doesn't hurt me so badly, because I notice that when I do shut down, that's when, like, I see a homeless person and I just can't even look at them and I can't do anything for them because I'm like, I just can't handle it. And I don't feel that that's helpful. So mm-hmm. I guess I've worked with myself to try to raise that up where I can, you know, give them a dollar or just give them a smile even, or just acknowledge their humanity and, mm-hmm. and not get sucked into this vortex of feeling just so badly for them.
Right.
So,
well, that's what this is about, isn't it? It's how to develop compassion and to take it the next step, because compassion, may they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So there's more of a activity mindedness to it. And actually, the way, if the Mahayana perspective is sort of like, hang on a minute, I'm going to read Jeffrey Hopkins here because he says it better than me. There are three forms of compassion according to the subjective aspect. When compassionate consciousness, what the compassionate consciousness is doing. The first perspective, how nice it would be if all beings were free from suffering and the causes. So that's a good start, isn't it? We could actually think that way. We could do this meditation, envision somebody that's suffering, that we care about. The second is the perspective, may they be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. So that's more active. How nice it would be. Now we're actually wishing, may they be free of suffering and the causes. And the third is, and this is the Bodhisattva ideal, this is quite different. It's like, I will free them from suffering and the causes of suffering. It's the attitude of the Bodhisattva is, I take personal responsibility, even though we know it can't be done because it's not been done. But the Bodhisattva has this heroic attitude of, I take personal responsibility for freeing beings from suffering and the causes of suffering. Totally, and if this is based on pure love and genuine love and compassion and not ego, it's totally antithetical to egocentricity, our biggest enemy. And it's a very powerful attitude, a very powerful antidote to the devil that lives in our heart, which is self-centered selfishness. Did you want to say something else?
I guess I was just thinking that might be something to do on the spot, like when I feel a resistance from this empathy thing lacking in compassion, that I could say that yeah. right there in my mind, and then maybe, you know, about that action.
Yeah.
Just to do something instead of getting wrapped up, because it is kind of a fear that I'm in danger,
mm-hmm.
you know, of losing myself into this emotion.
Right.
That makes me withhold and draw back and not be able to be compassionate.
Yeah. I think in the beginning, just having that first one, how nice it would be. I mean, walk down the street. How nice it would be if this person could be free of happiness and cause of happiness. How nice it would be if this insect could be free of happiness and cause of happiness. How nice it would be if this person that I don't particularly like could be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And those of you who not know how to do Tong Lin, by the way, it's very interesting that I've been reading all these texts on trying to develop bodhicitta, and a lot of the lamas, including my teachers and Geshe Gelug as well, say, you know, when you practice Tong Lin, people don't know what that is. Some of you don't know what that is, but it's a meditation where you visualize that you're. Actually, Tong Lin means giving and taking, but we practice it the other way around. Taking and giving, commentary on the Guru Puja, they go back to giving and taking, and I think that makes more in some sense. It makes more sense is that you have to feel love for somebody, so you give them love and the cause. You give them happiness and the cause of happiness, which is love. Now you care about them. Now you're willing to take their suffering. So I think they work together. By the time you do Tong Lin, you've already developed, if you're doing the meditations on bodhicitta, you're already feeling connected and so forth. But it does make sense to give them happiness, feel love for these beings, then take their suffering. And so we hook this to the breath. We imagine we're sending the white light of love and compassion out to these different beings. Sometimes, you know, we can do this while you're walking down the street. You can do it mindfully. You think, may they have happiness as the cause of happiness, and may they be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. And breathe out. May they have happiness. And go to a party and do this to everybody. Look right in their eyes and go, may you, you know, don't say it out loud, but may you have happiness. You know, and just notice how different the energy is. It's not about, oh my God, do I look okay? And, you know, I wonder if anybody likes me here or if I, blah, 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 you know, so self-centered. But actually practice, use that situation, even when we break today. Look at people and say, you know, may you have happiness and the cause of happiness. May you be free from suffering and the cause of suffering. Practice all day long. Bunches of opportunities. Watkins, my business partner back there, he wrote something on my cubicle right before I go in. I'm a family doctor at my daytime job. He said he's trying to encourage me to bring my Dharma practice to work. How dare him do that? But anyway, walk in there and think, may you have happiness and be free of suffering. That's a very good way to start any interaction, isn't it? Even if it's effortful. Eventually, we want to develop effortless love and compassion, not have it be so effortful, but that's what we're talking about. So anyway, any questions so far? I wanted to leave some time to do a meditation on equanimity. So we have plenty of time. We got some time anyway. What time do I have to quit?
About 10 to 12.
Okay. All right. So there are three different types of equanimity that we talk about. It's something that we're aware of. The first one is called an equanimity of feeling. And, you know, we're always having feelings, right? Can you get away from your feelings? You're having a feeling right now. It's either, there's one or three feelings that are going on all the time, and we have no choice in the matter. because it's sent because of the, you know, we don't have any control over our minds and feelings. As soon as our mind, visual mind or mental mind, comes into contact, or it's olfactory or auditory, you name it, rap music does not bring me a good feeling. Sorry. But I know for some, my kids love it, but I'm not a big fan of it. But feelings are always going on as soon as our mind connects with an object. So we're always having pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feelings. So there's a, so, you know, and then the neutral feelings are, we could call them sort of associated with indifference. That's not equanimity. That's a form of equanimity, but that's not what the equanimity of feeling is not what we're aiming for. That's still very samsaric, connected to cycle of suffering that we're trying to escape. Then the second is a equanimity of, I can't think of the name of it, but anyway, it has to do with in meditation, but particularly when we're trying to develop calm abiding, there's a point at which the mind is like completely free of attachment and aversion, and it's an advanced state of meditation where you feel totally equanimous. And that's all good and well. And that's what we need to get there, so we can have a more powerful meditation on, you know, on this universal equanimity that we're trying to have for all sentient beings, which is the third kind of equanimity. So that's what we're shooting for, is this equanimity that excludes nobody. And it's that becomes the foundation, the level ground, that then we can begin to develop love and compassion and good feelings. But without that, so one of the examples in the text is that it's like a shepherd who's looking over his flock, and he basically, you know, he sees all these sheep out there, but he has total equanimous. He definitely feels connected to them. I mean, he's aware of them, but it's a very neutral feeling he has. He wants all of these sheep to live. It's sort of like that. It's that, you know, so it's not that we don't have family and people that are kind to us, and it's not that we don't have people that are mean to us, and it's not that we don't have a vast number of people that we have never connected with. It's that we don't cling to that. We don't have attachment and clinging to the friends. We don't have aversion and hatred toward the so-called enemies, and we don't have, you know, blank indifference and, you know, just have no thought at all about this myriad of strangers that are out there. So this is what we're shooting for. This is the foundation that we can develop, you know, universal compassion. And this kind of equanimity is also aware that all beings want to be happy. All beings want to be free of suffering. Something that's, you know, we've talked about so many times in here. It's like the Dalai Lama, if you ever get to hear him speak, I mean, that's kind of the first thing he comes out of his mind is, you know, we all want to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. We're all the same. And we, it's okay. It's nothing wrong with wanting to be happy. You know, the only problem with wanting to be happy is when we get addicted to it. And then we have a problem. But wanting to be happy is a genuine, worthwhile. I mean, what is enlightenment? It's you want to be happy so you can help all sentient beings. You want to be enlightened so you can help all sentient beings. So we're going to do the meditation. I was going to read one little bit out of here. But it's going to take too much time, probably. I could read the meditation. Maybe I'll do that. But I'm going to give you my version of it first, so we can write this. I'll write this down. Oh, do you want to write it down? Okay. I'll give you. What's your name?
Link.
Say it again.
Link.
L-I-N-K? All right, Link. Thank you, Link. For all of you visually minded people, Link is going to help us out. So at the top, on the left-hand side, I want you to put friend and underline friend.
Okay.
Doesn't have to be too good. All right. So why do we label? And it is a label, isn't it? Why do we label people friends?
They're nice to us.
Huh?
They're nice to us.
Right. So put down nice to us. What else?
We like them.
We like them.
They feed our ego.
They feed our ego. Come on.
They're kind.
They're kind to us.
Yeah.
Kind to us.
Things in common.
Things in common. They make us feel good. Well, you got to feel good. Oh, feed our ego. What else? In the back. Let's get the back involved here. Let's get Meredith involved.
Trust.
Trust. We trust them. Yeah, thank you. They don't judge us, we think. Or if they do, they don't share it, right? Until they become our enemy, of course. Annabelle, have you got anything? Why do we call people friends? They give us stuff, right? Like squishies. They give us. They're friendly. Okay.
We can play together.
Play together. All right, and so on. So we get the picture, right? So that one of the qualities of attachment, and we are attached to our friends, right? One of the qualities of attachment is that we, whatever we see that brings a, and friends bring pleasant feelings, right? We don't even have as soon as you see a friend, immediately you have a pleasant feeling, right? And then right after that, attachment arises because we overestimate the positive qualities of a friend. And it could be a friend, it could be a cigarette, it could be a drug, it could be, you name it. It could be work. But we overestimate money. We overestimate the positive qualities of these so-called friends, and we underestimate the negative qualities. So we cling to the friend. So attachment arises for the friend, right? Yeah. So right away we're partial to our friends. Now, no room for strength. Let's go for enemies. Put enemies on the right side. Why do we call, what is it about people that ends up, again, we're too sophisticated to use that word enemy, and mentally we go, well, I don't like him, or whatever, but we could use the word aversion, whatever. So what are some of the things that make us dislike others, that label? And get this point. The point is, it is a label, isn't it? Our mind sees these people and we label them immediately. When they walk in the door, if they've done something in the past, like, go ahead, give us some examples, we label them enemy.
They are different from us.
They're different from us. Could be color of skin, could be ethnicity, could be size of their body, could be what they eat and what I eat. I mean, just what religion, all the, it could be anything.
They hurt us.
Take something we want.
They took something I wanted. Very, yeah.
I was going to say to go with that, conflicting desires or conflicting purpose.
Conflicting desire.
And they're against our agenda.
Against our agenda.
Cause fear.
Hey.
They're unfair.
They're unfair.
They're intent for us maybe harm.
Yeah. They intend to harm us.
Judging.
They're judgy.
We're aware of their judgment.
They judge us badly or something. Yeah.
They might be mean.
Yeah, mean, bullying, something like that.
They treat others mean.
Yeah, mean to others. That's a good start. Okay, so that's now at the bottom you can put strangers. At the bottom, yeah, okay, that's fine. We don't have that many to probably for strangers, but you know, you can talk. It's the person on the bus that's, or the subway, or the elevator, or walking down the street that does it. Anyway, why do we, you know, what is the experience with strangers? It's indifference, isn't it? So why do we feel that way?
Their lives don't appear to affect them.
Mm-hmm. So their lives, they don't affect me one way or the other. Right? You could just say, don't, what's another way to say that? I think that's good. Just say,
no apparent connection.
No apparent connection is good.
We don't know their issues yet.
Yeah. We're indifferent because we don't know much, we don't know anything about them. Pardon? Yeah, don't know them, don't care. I got other issues.
There's something also about like how you know you'll probably never see them again. Like they're just, you see them and then
right.
They're gone forever, and there was no
not attachment.
Yeah, I guess no connection. Not
right.
Attachment.
Right.
Not worth investing time in.
Mm-hmm. Just no feel. You know, the feeling is neutral. There's no feeling, there's no attachment or aversion, just neutral feeling. A big deal, you know. So it's the feeling of the neutral feeling that we were talking about, which is not helpful. Okay, I think those are good starts. All right, so so we can see that there's a lot of our mind. As long as our mind is pervaded by partiality, where we're labeling, you know, friends, enemies, and strangers. And those labels are fixed, aren't they? This is like, when we see the friend, it looks like the friend is coming from where? Where's the friend? Is the friend out there, or is the friend in my mind, or both? Yeah, there's no, well, you can't find a friend that exists independent of the mind labeling it. Right? So this, as long as Oka says, there's something there, but it's so subtle. So subtle. So our mind is responsible for these labels. Based on what? Something that happened. In the friend's case, you know, how stable is that? Right? How much we put such stock in our friends, you know, and yet how many people have been divorced? You know, how many people have had boyfriends or girlfriends that they don't like anymore? You know, you go from having, like, this person is the love of your life and you think they're so wonderful and you can see no fault, to like, can't even stand the sight of them anymore. Just, they walk in the room and you just, immediately aversion arises, whereas 10 years earlier when they walked in the room, you immediately felt ebullient. You know, you felt really happy. You had positive feelings. Now you have negative feelings. So they're changeable. These relationships are all in a state of flux. They're, you know, the friend can become the enemy can become the friend, the stranger can become the friend or the enemy. There's no stability. And yet, our mind, as soon as we see the friend, we think the friend comes from the side of the friend. We don't realize we made it up. And we also forget that these things are all impermanent, that they're constantly in a state of flux. Got that? Very important. So we're going to, when we do our meditation, so there's three kinds of compassion that we talk about in Tibetan Buddhism in general. So there's compassion for beings, and this is in this Chandrakirti, which is a great Buddhist saint. I wrote this down and memorized it one time, but I've forgotten it. But the first one is compassion, which is qualified by suffering. Okay? So So, again, you got to feel close to beings for you to feel compassion. I'm going back to the first subject we talked about. You have to feel close to them. But you also have to recognize their suffering. So, you know, the people that are at the peak of samsara, which are, you know, the movie stars and the well, I don't know about the politicians, but, you know, all those people that are supposed to be so great and have tons of money and the people inside the Beltline and all of those, all those great people, you know, that have everything and have it made, and they're good looking and they're smart and they have a big bank account and they go on great vacations and they're married to an attractive person and have 2.2 beautiful kids and that are all smart and above average, like they say Garrison Keillor says. What does Garrison Keillor say? Your wife is good looking.
And they're good looking and the children are above
that. Yes. Yeah, so that. So you know, we all kind of, you know, aim for that kind of situation, but we don't always get there. So the reality is that beings are suffering. And we talk about three kinds of suffering. We kind of talk about obvious suffering, okay? What is that? That's depression. That's being stressed out. That's getting sick. That's getting old. That's dying. That's leaving, being separated again and again from desirable experiences, meeting again and again with undesirable experiences, dying and taking, if you believe in rebirth, if you want to go with the rebirth game, it's dying in life after life, having to meet with difficult situations and people again and again. You know, it's like, and it number of times we've died, if we took our skeletons, Mount Everest would be like a molehill compared to how many bodies we've taken and the suffering we've done and so on. I mean, that kind of thinking really puts it in context. So we've suffered not only in this life, but in countless past lifetimes, and we will again in the future. And it's just suffering of old age, sickness, and death, but everything else that brings us, that upsets our mind, that disturbs our peace, you know, because we're so addicted to pleasurable experiences and deliciousness. And what are we, the more we crave deliciousness, the more we what? Dread the opposite, which is non-deliciousness, which is pain, suffering, disgrace, blame, anything that we consider to be negative, sickness, old age, and death. It's all the same. The flip side of the coin. So here we are, caught in this world where you think you're the only one having a hard time. We're all having a hard time. Even the beautiful people, even the inside the Beltline crowd, even the Hollywood, New York, Manhattan crowd. Everybody's is in samsara, caught in this process. All right. Then there's the suffering of change, which means that no matter how wonderful it is, it's not going to last. We're going to be left wanting more. We can never be satisfied with the kind of mind we have. Everything changes. Everything goes out of existence. Every pleasurable experience has a beginning, middle, and end. And we're left craving, wanting more of that. And every unpleasant experience, thankfully, has a beginning, middle, and end. And we're left craving to not experience that again. Right? Same thing. So this is suffering of change. Nothing lasts. We're sitting here in a chair, if we are on a cushion, you're comfortable now. But after about 5 hours, you'll be begging to get up, right? Because it'll change. And you go outside and it's a little chilly and you go, wow, it feels good out here. But after a while you get cold and you got to come in. It's like that. It's constantly going on. All the things that we now label pleasant or pleasurable are part of this changeable, what we call suffering, but it sounds a little harsh. It just basically means it's unsatisfactory. It will never bring us what we want, which is lasting satisfaction. And the last kind of suffering is pervasive suffering. We're caught in a process of uncontrolled causation. We have no control. I don't care who you are. You cannot, if I ask you to meditate, I'm going to just guess. Very few people in this room that could count 21 without getting lost. on about 5 or 6 or 10, and it'd be this difficult to go in and out 1, in and out 2, in and out 3. Most of the time you get lost, and because we have very little control over our mind. We're caught, and then we have no control over who's going to come in our lives today or tomorrow. You know, difficulties are just queuing up. Right now, problems are queuing up for tomorrow. You don't know what they are, but they'll show up. You'll have to deal with them. And then next week, and I can tell you, in the next 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years, if you live that long, they're queuing up for big time suffering then. As I'm experiencing, and a lot of my patients tell me, getting old is not for sissies. Okay? So sickness, old age, and death, it's all there. So that's, and we're caught in this process of lifetime after lifetime. So this is the suffering of self. This is the first kind of suffering that helps develop compassion. The second kind of suffering is the suffering of beings qualified by impermanence, which sounds a little bit like what we just talked about. That, you know, the example of that is looking at water on a lake or in a bucket where the water is always rippling. It's always in a state of flux. That our mind and our body are constantly in a state of flux, and we're clinging. We're clinging to thoughts, and we're clinging to our health, and we're clinging, constantly clinging in a world qualified by impermanence. So that's another way to develop compassion for others, is understanding that all of us are qualified by impermanence, constantly in this state of flux. Our mind and our body. And then the last one is beings qualified by emptiness. So we won't talk about that one. No, we will. That's actually the most profound one. So how, those of you who understand emptiness, I'll give you the 25 word or less version of emptiness, okay? Those of you who are, you know, because I don't understand it completely. No, but, you know, intellectually, it is understandable, but to get it is really a challenge. But since we talked about earlier how, for example, you know, if everybody would agree this is a water bottle, right? Yeah, this is a water bottle. Anybody disagree with that? All right. Okay, now, where does the water bottle exist? Is it in your mind, or is it here? Like, if you'd never seen this before, would you be able to call it a water bottle? If a dog came in, would a dog think, oh, there's a water bottle? No, a dog would come over and grab it and start chewing on it, you know? It's like a toy. Different label. So, you know, the existence of water bottle exists upon, you know, an object that we label, the process of labeling. Everything exists upon the process of labeling. And so friend, enemy, and stranger exists in the process of labeling. There's nothing that exists independent of our mind labeling it. There's nothing out there that exists independent of our mind labeling it. So, if everybody goes out of the room and this water bottle, whatever this is, which is really what? A collection of atoms. That's all it is. There's a lot more space here than is solidity. If everybody goes out of the room, can you say there's a water bottle in the room? You could say that. But you don't have a connection with this. It may not be here. It may disappear. You can't say. Now, if somebody's in here that sees it as a water bottle, it still exists as a water bottle for them. But for you, it doesn't exist as a water bottle because you're not connected to it. You're connected to the memory of water bottle. But you can't say there's a water bottle here. It depends upon an object that you can label. So, here's the gist of it. Because there's no inherent reality that exists independent of our mind labeling it, right? We can sort of think about it as literally like in front of us is this blank screen. And our mind is the projector of our lives. And we are creating our own reality. We're projecting Kadampa Center. You got your friends from Meredith. We've got our friends from Kadampa Center, people we know, people we don't know. Our mind is creating, whether I like it, I dislike it, whatever experience we have of ourselves being in this space, and the whole thing is a creation of our mind. It exists independent upon the object that we label. But it's a creation of our mind. Our mind is, and where does the projector come from? Where do the frames come from? They come from the past. That's why you can call this a water bottle, only because you've seen it in the past. So all the frames that create our lives are created by past karmic imprints based on actions. Virtuous actions create frames that cause us to be happy. Non-virtuous actions that harm others and ourselves create frames that cause the projector to create us, see ourselves as suffering. So what do you want to do? You want to be happy? Be virtuous. Not because it's a good, not because God said so, or the Buddha said it was a good idea, or that's what they, no, that's how reality is constructed. It's constructed. It makes sense to practice virtue and not harm others, because that's the cause of our own happiness. It's practical. And if you want to suffer, just follow your ego. Follow your self-centered mind. Do whatever feels good when you want to do it, no matter how it affects anybody else. Just go with it and find out where you end up. We all know where you end up. You end up suffering. We can see that even in this lifetime. Selfish self-centeredness causes suffering. So again, if we want the frames to project, because the reality is empty, if we want our world to be a happy one, it all ties back to karma and ethics. That's how the world is constructed. And so how does that lead to compassion? How does understanding emptiness cause us compassion to rise? Anybody?
Difference between you or anyone else outside of the mind.
But how does that cause compassion to arise?
From my understanding, that once you understand emptiness, you understand the interconnectedness of reality.
Okay, now how does that cause compassion to arise?
With that realization comes that if there's nothing to do other than love that which you experience and see, because it is so interwoven with your own. Yeah.
Okay, I think we're on the same page here. I think one of the things that emptiness does, and I've heard different explanations, but it also, because things are interdependent, no doubt, and interconnected and interwoven, but also because things are empty, a bodhisattva or a Buddha, somebody who realizes how the world is constructed and sees countless living beings totally unaware of it. And creating suffering, like you would, in other words, creating the causes of suffering like they're our friend, and running away from the causes of happiness. You know? Because someone who understands emptiness sees how much suffering is in the world, and it's based on a misknowledge. It's based on not understanding reality and going around harming others and following attachment and following the mind of aversion and thinking they're our friends and just going with the flow. And that's completely wrong. It's completely self-destructive. So a Buddha or a Bodhisattva or a highly realized being sees the suffering in the world and how pointless it is and unnecessary because people don't understand reality. And it literally breaks their heart in a compassionate way. It only causes compassion to be more powerful and stronger, because they see how this suffering is going on, and it's unnecessary. It's unnecessary because people don't understand reality. Okay, so now we're almost out of time. We got a few minutes, so why don't you take a seat, and let's do this. Do a little meditation on these three categories of being. If you need to stretch your legs, just feel free to do that. So again, this is what we want. You know, our goal is ultimately is to help others, and the method to do that is develop an attitude of universal compassion and wisdom. We need to become a Buddha. We need to fully develop our qualities, eliminate our faults, and this quality of having a compassionate mind is so important. And the foundation of this is this mind of equanimity, this mind of this level-mindedness that we strive for. So there are actually two quick ways to do this, you might say. One is one technique is to look at the three categories of beings in front of you, and you could start out with each one, but just all right. So focus on the so-called friend, somebody that you feel attachment toward, and you understand why we put the reasons down here, why you feel attachment toward the friend. And so you want attachment and that pleasant feeling to arise in your mind. All right, and then you want to understand why you develop this attitude. You know, they said something nice to me, they were kind to me, they didn't judge me and so forth. They were a friend to my ego, which by the way is of my worst enemy. So is the friend of my worst enemy really my friend? And this relationship has no stability. It is complete. We think it's going to last forever. It won't last. Promise you, there's no friend that you have now that's going to be your friend forever and ever to the end of endless time, you know? These relationships are changeable. So we get some sense that, yes, this person, they're not my enemy. That's not the point, is to turn this person to an enemy. But in past lives, they've been my enemy. This is the other kind of thinking we can use. The first one is to see the changeability of these relationships. The other one is to see that in past lives, again, if you can open your mind to playing the rebirth game, in past lives, they've been very kind to me. But they've also been my worst enemy. They've harmed me. They've sliced my body up in little pieces and put it in refrigerators and did things like that. And they were so mean to me. But in this lifetime, a few nice words, they were kind to me. So we want to understand this relationship in the context of beginningless time and how it has been all over the place. This lifetime, they get the label friend, but it's not solid. It's not permanent. Then you go to the so-called enemy, a person you feel aversion toward. And again, we think about the impermanence of that, the impermanent nature we think about why. Let's think about why they're our enemy. I mean, you know, it could be a political figure. It could be someone in real life that you have to live with every day or see at work every day, like a boss or a coworker, whatever works for you. You want to allow the mind of aversion and this unpleasant feeling to arise in your mind. And then be aware that this is not permanent either. This relationship is subject to change. It's just a label. Based on the things that we wrote up here, something happened that set it off in the wrong direction. They started out as strangers, by the way. Everybody did. They started out as strangers, but they quickly moved into the category of people that we feel aversion toward. And we have a reason for it. All those reasons, very, very egocentric reasons, like he or she harmed me. They did something bad to me. It's all about me and my ego and how I interpreted this. But this is changeable. This relationship is subject to change. could be. And while you're looking at this person, you want to think about how it's changeable, and so you can let go of this clinging to aversion that is harming you. You have to think about this. This harms you more than it harms the person. Long after the person's dead and gone, you know, this aversion that you feel has planted imprints in your mind that can cause you to suffer for a long, 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 long time to come. Okay? So you need to know that. Aversion harms you. Harms you in the moment, harms you in the future. And you can take strong action against anybody without being motivated by hatred and aversion. You can be motivated by compassion, actually. Understanding that this person acts the way they do because of delusions, just like you do, just like everybody else does. They're delusional. Okay? All right, so you see that that's a changeable relationship. Just a few kind words. All of a sudden, that person could be over in the category of friends. Well, we all have friends that we grew up with. We don't even see them anymore. They're strangers now. Wouldn't even recognize them. Right? So this is changeable. And then in past lifetimes, this so-called enemy has been as dear and kind to us as our mother, as our family members of this lifetime. So we think about it that way. And the point is to work with whichever technique is helpful for your mind until you can let go of that mind. Bring this image of this person that you feel aversion toward at least closer to the point of neutrality. Okay? All right? And then the stranger, you think, okay, well, in past lifetimes, anyway, that's an impermanent relationship because a kind word to a stranger, they become a friend. A mean word to a stranger, they become an enemy. You know, vast majority of people we don't care about, we don't connect to. But it's a changeable relationship. You know, and in past lifetimes, they've been our dear parent. They've also been mean and hateful to us. Yeah, we definitely have a connection to this being. We feel totally disconnected, but we have a connection. And they're just like us. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. The friend wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. The stranger wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. The enemy wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. We're all equal in that very important way. So now, when you get to the point where you've let go of a little bit of the clinging to the friend and let go of a little bit of the aversion to the enemy and the let go of a little bit of the indifference toward the stranger, just try to let your mind rest in that space of equanimity for just a couple of minutes. Okay, now bring your attention back in the room and open your eyes. Now, how can we use this in our day-to-day lives? This is such a juicy topic. I did want to read one little piece here. Again, I can't see it very well. All right, it says, once this feeling of equality becomes apparent, both in your meditative practice and in your everyday feelings, you will realize that this equalization will occur without discrimination or distinction. This is the first step. Seeing them all as your dear friends can come later. At this stage, the cost might be slight distance from people in general, but the reward is an equanimity that can grow into boundless compassion. While we are contemplating and comparing others, it is wholly important to remember that we must never stop observing our behavior at all times. This is the part of it. Watch your own behavior as you walk down the street. I'm sure you will find that you connect with certain individuals and recoil from others. This is a continuous process. We find ourselves smiling at adorable children and their strollers, but we try to stray away from homeless men asking us for spare change. By working through this meditation, we are taking the various points of equanimity very seriously and diligently working to see the benefits of developing this mind of immeasurable equanimity. It's necessary to take this process step by step, be creative in our visualizations, and developing a method that makes sense to our own personal minds. This is not, however, a process that we take up at the beginning of our practice and abandon later in life. It is a sequence of practices that will be helpful for the rest of our lives. It is the true core of Buddhism, and from equanimity, all of the great minds can develop. So this is no light. This is, and I will tell you this, of all the practices I've meditated on, this is the most helpful one to my mind. This in Tonglen, but particularly the one where looking at the enemy and anybody having a hard time with and trying to think of positive, you know, let the negative mind arise and then come up with various reasons like the impermanence nature of them and in past lives and whatever works for your mind. I mean, sometimes it can be like, well, that's my karma, you know. The Shantideva, you know, Shantideva talked about this, you know, somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get mad at the stick, right? You get mad at the person. Well, in this situation, when somebody harms us, what's the real source of the harm? It's our own former negative actions. It's the karma coming back. The person that harms us is just the vehicle by which our negative karma expresses itself. So, you know, you can use different reasonings that work for your mind. And who teaches us patience? Not our friends, our enemies. Patience is the source of all great spiritual realizations. There's no happiness without patience. We need enemies. We need difficult people in our lives. So again, you use all kinds of reasonings, Dharma reasonings, to help your mind develop this important attitude. So thank you for your attention. So let's do dedication.
Okay, if you'll turn to page 246 in your Gold Prayer Book. And we'll read Master Shantideva's dedication.
By the way, we need to thank Link for... Good job. All right.
May all beings everywhere plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain a notion of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. But I'm going to stop and just say, this is a great prayer for what Don has just been talking about for the last hour. It's developing that love and compassion and equanimity toward everyone. Okay, sorry. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit.
May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments.
Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you, Don.
Amen.
And I've got a couple of quick announcements. Just a reminder that this coming weekend there's a Vajrasattva purification retreat out at Nolan's Farm, and there's still spots available if anybody's interested. Also starting in a couple of weeks, we've got this great opportunity to learn how to draw Tibetan sacred art with Jompel, our artist who he had the design for the stupa and oversaw that and did all the decorations on it. He did all the painting on Geshe Gelug's throne, on the Tara, on the Tara's altar, and he's done lots of tankas for a lot of people here at the center. There's a beautiful big one right on the other side of this wall that's mainly kind of pink, and he did that. So he's this really amazing, skillful artist, and it's amazing that he's going to share his talent with us. So if you're interested in taking that class, registration for that is open. And then we have Lori Robbins here today who's got a special announcement for us.
Good morning, everyone. I am going to read off my notes so I don't forget anything. I want to share with you an incredible opportunity that Lama Zopa Rinpoche has provided for us to practice generosity and bodhicitta. When we practice generosity, we are applying the exact antidote to attachment, and that's something that Lama Zopa Rinpoche says. For me, when I recite daily prayers, such as taking refuge in the seven-limb prayer, I'm reminded to make offerings and practice generosity. This can be difficult to translate into my daily life to affect change in my mind. And then to add in bodhicitta brings in a whole new level of challenge. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche has provided us with an opportunity to practice these perfections every day, every week, or as often as we can. The Merit Box Project allows us to make a tangible effort to practice generosity with bodhicitta. Through the projects the Merit Box supports, we are helping so many other sentient beings. Isn't that bodhicitta? There's two amazing benefits for our mind at the same time. The actual practice is easy. Place the Merit Box on your altar or another convenient location. This is one of the Merit Boxes. Generate your motivation with bodhicitta. Make an offering from one penny to your whole wallet. You can do what you can. And then dedicate the merits. That's it. Practice every day to maximize your benefit. And then before Lama Tsongkhapa Day in the fall, we'll collect the boxes to send in the contributions to provide Dharma to other sentient beings. So this is kind of a list of how the Merit Box donations are used. Over the past 16 years, the Merit Box Project has collected and distributed more than $1 million to FPMT projects around the world. Our own dear Kadampa Center has received extremely helpful grants for 4 of the 5 Light of the Path retreats. Last year alone, we received $8,717 to host the retreat for over 200 people. The grants support some wonderful projects at FPMT centers around the world. In London, a Repaying the Kindness initiative, which brought caring to caregivers through programs like yoga, counseling, celebrations, group trips, and art therapy. And in Australia, they developed a training program for caregivers to provide Buddhist-inspired spiritual care to the sick and dying. Grants have also supported building stupas, statues, and retreat cabins, translating sacred texts, publishing books, supporting sangha, and providing educational opportunities. So you can see this Merit Box project impacts many sentient beings around the world. Don't miss this amazing opportunity to transform your mind and get your free Merit Box today. I don't want to forget this. This book has a practice in it that Lama Zopa Rinpoche wrote that you can do if you don't have an idea of how you want to do it. You can use it to support your generosity. So thank you very much. Oh, there are boxes in the lobby right outside by the circular table right outside in the hall. Do you need them? Thank you.
Thanks. That was great. Never had it said so eloquently, I think. That was really helpful. Just so we're doing the Count Me In campaign, and the next one up, the next position up, we'll start with what we need, still need. So we, what do we have first? The front desk position. So you can talk to me about if you'd like to be part of greeting people and helping out, and then working on the shed, and then what was the other one? Protocol writer. So we still need one or two more protocol writers. If you're technical minded, just talk to me. So this week's job we're looking for is just one person to be a kitchen manager, or several. We can make it a team. So once a week to come in, and Friday's like the volunteer bonanza day here. It's quite fun. If we had someone that could come in and just make sure the kitchen looks good for Sunday. It's not a big deal. It's not hard to do. Organize it a little bit. Wash dishes if there's anything left. Put things away and make it clean. Yeah, and keep it supplied. Keep everything cooking. Look in the refrigerator and say, wow, it's green. It goes. So it doesn't require a big skill level.